Blog Talk Radio.
And we're live from 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. Shelley's Back Room, America's Cigar Tavern. If it's Tuesday, 4 o'clock, that means it's time for Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio, our weekly roundtable of all things political, all things international affairs, all things that happen and affect you and your community and your state, and on the whole, and as general, the nation as a whole. With us is our usual roundtable of political insiders and pundits. Starting to my left, he is a former eight-term member of Congress from Washington State's 2nd District, former Vice President of Government Affairs for Burlington Northern Railroad. He is the Honorable Congressman Al Swift. Congressman, welcome back.
Welcome to Tuesday.
We missed you last Tuesday.
I was elsewhere, but I'm glad to be back.
I will tell you that being a Democrat is really hard when you're not here. I feel like I got to take up that line for you.
I'm sure you do an excellent job.
I wish it was that easy. As easy as Mandarin. Directly across from you here in the smoke-encrusted nerve center of Backroom Politics, he is the former floor staff chief for Gerald Ford, congressman from Michigan. He is the former vice president of the National Broadcasting Corporation, former board member of the National Association of Broadcasters, and general veteran of politics inside the Beltway. He is the Honorable, what is your name again? He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, welcome back.
I feel like I must be 100 years old with that long an introduction. We got to shorten it.
Well, he got the introduction.
I got the introduction right for the first time.
Then he couldn't remember your name.
Easy come, easy go.
Hey, you know what? We take what we can get here at Backroom Politics. Sitting to my right, he is the vice president of the Eurasia Center. He is a bar licensed attorney in the great state of New York and here in the District of Columbia. He is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Ralph, welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks, Justin. Glad to be here.
Thank you for joining us. It has been, as usual, a busy week in between Backroom Politics shows. We've got a lot to get to. The thing that's got everybody spinning here in Washington today is the continuing budget crisis here in your nation's capital. Can we stave off a government shutdown? Can we come up with a budget for 2011? Can we come up with a budget for 2012 that everybody will enjoy? But there was a lot of activity going on even today as we were coming on the air. Things were happening with two possibilities going on. Looking at the first possibility is the one-week continuation of the continuing resolution being sponsored by the Republican Party, an effort that President Obama says he will veto outright. And that's kind of a gutsy move on the president, almost ensuring a government shutdown. Now, our in-house parliamentarian, Bob Hines, today close of business for the Hill is the last day we can get some sort of resolution preventing a government shutdown. Is that correct?
Well, we don't have to vote on it today, but the rules of the House, a rule that the Republican added to the rules of the House when they took over this January, requires that all bills and resolutions have to be available 3 days before they can be voted on. That was basically put in because of the Obamacare health fair that nobody had seen and nobody knew what was really in it, and it passed because the Democrats had the numbers to do it. and the Republicans trying to show they wanted everybody to be able to read the bills, although I don't think any members are specifically reading bills now, but they gave everybody an opportunity to know what was in the bill.
And
so that requires they'd have to have a bill that they can introduce by tonight so it could be available for 3 days before they vote on it on Friday.
Al, as a former member of Congress, you've been familiar and you've had your finger on the pulse of what's been going on here inside the Beltway. Do you think that they can get a piece of paper in the hopper ready to go for the three-day review term?
No. And I think what this shows is that clearly what the Democrats did that caused this rules change was outrageous. But anytime you write a rule, you better have an escape hatch. We were talking on this program a couple of weeks ago about whether or not Congress should actually declare war in the case of an emergency.
Right.
And we didn't quite resolve that. But if, in fact, this country were attacked and you could not counterattack until Congress had acted and you came into this three-day thing,
yeah.
You know. We can't fight back.
We can't fight back. Hey, time out. We got 3 days for public comment.
Right. So I think it's a case of writing a rule which makes sense 99% of the time.
But when you really need it.
When you really need an escape valve, they didn't build one in.
Well, and by the way, for those of you who are listening, our loyal followers and those new to the program, this is an open call-in show. Any topic, political, international affairs, is welcome. Your comments, your questions for our roundtable. You can call us live at 619-638-8477. Again, 619-638-8477. We will put you on the air live with our roundtable. Also, I want to mention at 5 o'clock hour, we've got a live in-studio guest tonight. He is the Reverend Joe Williams, a longtime D.C. political insider here on issues relating to D.C. government. He is also the executive director of Emanus Council on Aging and just an all-around good insider when it comes to what's happening inside the mayor's office here in Washington. But that's in our 5 o'clock hour. Going back to our topic at hand, Bob, when we look at what's going on, we talked about the escape hatch of new rules changes. Obviously, this is something that's going to come back and bite the Democrats in the rear end. Is there any way that the Democrats can stave off disaster in this? Can they spin this issue right now to their benefit, or are the Republicans just going to walk away and charge up, go, hey, we called it?
I have always thought that the number one, somebody always gets blamed for a shutdown. Number two, usually if it is a shutdown, it is usually not the party in power's, the president. It's usually not his party. And you will recall that in the 90s, when it was shut down, when Speaker Gingrich and the Republicans shut the government down, Mr. Clinton basically railed against it, and his popularity ratings went up significantly, and the Republicans suffered in the next election. I don't think it ever makes sense to shut the government down. It's psychologically, it just sounds like a stupid thing to do.
Well, and presidents have the bully pulpit. Ronald Reagan did shut the government down, and blamed Congress for it.
Right.
Then Congress shut it down, and Congress got blamed for it. And now it looks like Congress again is going to shut it down, and my guess is Congress will get blamed for it.
But
again,
we got a different situation here in this Congress, this year's Congress, versus the Congress that was back in play under Newt Gingrich's speakership in the 90s, whereas we have a divided Congress, where we have a Democratic leadership under Harry Reid in the Senate, and then we have a Republican House under John Boehner, and even that's fractured right now.
But it is so clear to me, maybe I'm the only one, but it seems so clear that the Republicans in the House are, as you said, fractured, that John Boehner has tried to run with the $30 billion cut that the Republicans proposed. opposed, got shot down.
Right.
We have the new chairman of the Budget Committee who's coming up with something today. I presume we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
That looks, not that I agree with all of it, but it looks like it's realistic. It's in the real world. And then you got the Tea Party people who they're smoking their tea these days, you know, rather than drinking. And I said on this program a long time ago, we should just let them shut it down, and it'd be the fastest way to teach these Tea Party types what it really means to shut the government down. They probably won't learn it any other way.
I think what makes this very problematic is the fact that Boehner does not like Senator Reid and President Obama. They don't have a close personal working relationship. They despise each other. And that complicates your ability to bring people together and reach a compromise.
Well,
I also agree with Al that the Tea Party members of Congress are playing a huge role. And they could inevitably force a government shutdown, but that would play into Obama's hands.
Yeah, I think despise, I think, might be a strong word. I mean, there's a mutual respect there that every speaker and every Senate majority leader or Senate president has for the executive office of the president, and vice versa.
I'm talking about the personal side
of it.
That plays a role in it.
Obviously, there's not the close personal relationship that we've had in the past between those three offices. But the trick we have right now is, and something that Speaker Boehner is getting criticized for, Bob, is that his ability is, has he lost control of the Republicans in the House? Does he have the total support of the party with him as the leader of the party in Congress?
I don't think it's a matter of personalities at all. I think it's a question of the Tea Party people have arrived with an agenda, which a great number of them, not all, but a great number of them continue to believe is more important than anything else. I know that the Speaker and the rest of the leadership have been trying to help them understand that you don't have to get all the cuts you want in the continuing resolution for the fiscal year 2011, the day after however we solve this problem with the 2011 budget, the next day the budget committee starts tomorrow in holding hearings on the budget for the calendar for the fiscal year that begins October 1 of this year, 2012. So literally, I mean, there's going to be plenty of opportunity for all kinds of adjustments to the budget numbers that the president has offered in the next budget cycle. There's no need to do it all now, but they seem to have this feeling that we're going to do it now no matter what, and that is not a politically wise move, I think, because I think that they ought to be able to get as much as they can and then come back again.
Al?
Boehner may be getting some criticism, but I think it's unfair. I think you state the situation accurately. I don't think it's his fault. He didn't elect all of those Tea Party types. The American public in various places elected them, and they were not subtle about what they were going
to
do.
Well, they're trying to keep their campaign promises, but sometimes the reality of
what
the situation.
What a hell of a time to start doing that.
But the reality of the situation is they're going to have to compromise to avoid a government shutdown. Otherwise, you're going to create greater problems.
But the point is that a compromise now doesn't mean they're giving, quote, anything away in any real sense. Because literally, they'll have an opportunity to continue to cut the president's 2012 budget beginning tomorrow.
Well, you know, the funny thing that I'm seeing from a leadership standpoint is, you know, we've said before that, you know, the president and the White House can't get a message out. But when it comes down to cowboying up and getting leadership roles set, it seems that the president's actually trumped Congress in saying, look, I want you here every day until you get this thing worked out. If you don't get it worked out today, I want you back at the White House tomorrow, and I want an update. He's showing the leadership qualities, I think, and will probably benefit from this latest go-around of a continuing resolution, without question.
I think that's true.
But the criticism now goes back to Harry Reid holding firm on party lines, not budging, and Boehner being, for lack of a better term, held beholden to the Tea Party leadership. Majority Leader Cantor has been very vocal about this. He has stated that we're going to hold firm on our party line, and the compromise is beyond the thought process at this point. We're too far apart.
Well, what about what's in the best interest of the American people? Have both the Democrats and the Republicans thought about that?
Okay, I mean, look, we're in Washington D.C.
Yes.
Well, every politician inside the Beltway, lobbyist or elected, is sitting there saying, "I have the best interest of the elected people."
Well, they may
people.
Say that, but actions speak louder than words.
Always remind ourselves there are some policy issues that were in the original Republican proposal that had the $31 billion that the president so magnanimously says, I am supporting because I've agreed to their proposal. But he said very quietly, even this afternoon, he said, but there are policy issues of which we disagree. The president is no more agreeing than the man in the moon is.
Well, we have a caller on the line. Caller, you're on the air on Backroom Politics. What's your question?
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, sir. No, the question, not so much a question as a comment. I think what you're seeing happening here, first of all, the House Republicans are dealing with discretionary spending, which is 14% of our overall spending. If you cut it all, you cannot balance the budget. The problem here is that you have too many corporations who have their hands in other people's pocket, especially on the right side, and they're not addressing the real issues. And I think when you talk about Harry Reid and Obama to a certain degree, they're not going to allow one side when I say one side, I mean the poor to front this whole bill. Okay, you have corporate tax loopholes, which the president has tried to close, which the Pelosi Congress passed and went through the Senate and was blocked up and stopped up by the Senate, where these people, Exxon is paying zero tax. You have 42 companies that are located offshore that write off what's going on onshore. And then they get a 0% tax or they get tax rebates. We need to close those loopholes and shorten our tax our corporate tax rate in this country. There's a Wyden-Gregg bill that's been sitting there for over a year that would knock the tax rate down in this country to 25% for corporations inside the country. And the Democrats would gladly go along and do it if you took care of the other problem. And with that, we would help our deficit because we have a three-pronged deficit. And this is bipartisan across the board. Every conservative, liberal, even the bipartisan commission agrees with the idea. If the non-political people agree with the idea that, you know, the deficit problem that we're facing right now is A, because of the 2008 meltdown where we lost a third of our economy, and we need the jobs back. Two, we have a 6% for the next 5 years between 15 and 21. We have a 6% tax deficit. And the third problem is Medicare and Medicaid. Now, Medicare and Medicaid is going to take some time to work out, and we all know that. But the bottom line is if you close the tax loopholes for the offshore corporations and brought down the corporate tax inside the United States to 25% for the corporations in the United States, working in the United States, we would get an influx of jobs here, and we would take care of at least half of our deficit problem. The Republican Congress, Republican Congress doesn't seem to be willing to do that, and the Democrats are basically saying, "Look, we're not going to, you know, just, you know, indiscriminately cut the discretionary spending so that you can try to make yourself look good here." Because
Al, go ahead.
By and large, I agree with you. Some of those things are already in the pipeline. I think you may see an approach to the 20% reduction in Paul Ryan's bill that he will be coming out with. Now, whether it gets balanced by something benefiting the poor or not remains to be seen. But I'm really very anxious to get past this nonsense about shutting the government down and getting down to what are going to be the hard questions.
Questions about, as the caller pointed out, questions of Medicaid, questions of Medicare,
exactly
questions
what he pointed
of Planned
out.
Parenthood.
And Paul Ryan, in what I consider an act of leadership, I may not agree with very much of what he proposes, but he is proposing a serious budget. And the Tea Party is not proposing a serious action at all. They are frivoling, they're frittering away the American people's patience, and they're going to need that patience to understand why they need to absorb some cuts, perhaps some tax increases along the line.
Right.
And this dithering nonsense of the Tea Party is only going to frustrate the
public. Bob, go ahead.
And in fairness, I would say, with all due respect, that the president's budget isn't really a very sensible and sound policy bill either. It doesn't address any of the problems of the deficit. I think that the president's commission, the
Erskine-Bowles Commission, right,
with Senator Simpson, and I think Alice Rivlin and Peterson, both had good ideas, and I think as Al says, Ryan is at least trying to lay something out there and let people look at it. There are three serious proposals, in effect.
Yeah, and the situation was that neither party, the president or the Republicans in the House, wanted to stick their foot in the water first.
That's right.
Ryan is doing that.
It's going to be very interesting, caller, to see how the Tea Party reacts to this new budget that the Republicans have put out. In the budget, they talk about making the corporate tax to 25% and cutting all the loopholes that you referenced in your speech.
Caller, we're coming up on the break. We appreciate your call. Please continue to listen. Please call in again. We're going to be taking a two-minute break right now. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio, live from Shelley's Back Room in Washington, D.C. Stay with us. And we're live back here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. This is Blog Talk Radio's Back Room Politics, live from Shelley's Back Room. We invite you, all of our listeners, to call in, area code 619-638-8477. Again, 619-638-8477. We're here with Al Swift, Bob Hines, Ralph Winnie, and I'm your moderator, Justin Russell. We're talking about the current budget crisis going on here in Washington, D.C. Bob, during the break, you were talking about Paul Ryan, congressman and chairman of the Budget Committee in the House of Representatives, Republican from Wisconsin, really making a tour de force of his budget. It is a truly legitimate budget, something we haven't seen inside the Beltway, and I would argue several years. You'd agree with that, Bob?
Yeah, I would. As a matter of fact, there are the best thing about this budget is that it is a serious approach. I would, with all fairness, say I didn't think the president's budget was really that focused when he put his out a month ago. This is a serious approach, just like the Bowles-Simpson approach, the commission that the president appointed last year, and the Alice Rubin Pete Peterson approach. So there are several solutions laying on the table now. The really interesting thing is going to be how we come up with an answer. Now, the Democrats are obviously going to be supporting the president's proposals, but that doesn't deal with the problems of Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and those things have to be dealt with because those are the things. The discretionary spending part of the budget is about 12% of the budget, and the entitlements are 40% of the budget. So you can get rid of all the discretionary spending, and you're still going to have a huge deficit. You have got to deal in one way or another with reducing the cost of the entitlement program. And he just had no choice but to do it.
But Al, as the caller pointed out before the break, he was talking about the tax loopholes, the tax breaks. From a Democratic standpoint, does that make sense to address those, in one swoop, or is this a gradual term? Or do we possibly hamper our competitiveness here inside our own borders by making companies pay higher tax rate into our economy?
I think the time has come for the Democrats to finally make the point, which they have tried to make but failed to make, and that is that the Republicans are talking nonsense when they say they're going to balance the budget without having some tax increases. Now, there are a number of ways they can do that, and the more popular way would begin to talk exactly about the things you're doing. And Paul Ryan does some of that, closing loopholes and so forth and so on. That won't get us there. But it's a place where both people can start. And ultimately, I think it's going to, when you add the figures up, and the press will add the figures up, you're still going to need to have some additional revenue.
Well, Al, that's exactly right. We can't say we can get it by just cutting costs. We have to raise more revenue.
Well, let me throw this out there. And Ralph, I divert to you on this, but it would make sense also that, the tax loopholes have a certain benefit, whether it's through R&D makes our technology more competitive with the government-subsidized R&D that happens in places like Korea, Japan, the EU. Do we in fact close those loopholes and take ourselves out of a competitive circle with the rest of the global economy?
We have to make it advantageous for companies to come over here and to set up operations, like Chinese, Korean, Russian companies, to keep them from going to other countries and taking away valuable opportunities that could be created for American business through global partnerships.
But, Al,
look, there are very few federal expenditures that have absolutely no value whatsoever. You might find one or two. Well, I think there's an agency on tourism that maybe we could get along without. But they're very, very few. What you're going to be dealing with, whether you're doing tax increases or spending cuts, is you're going to be looking for the ones that will do the least damage.
Bob, can our country right now deal with a contraction of the federal government?
Well, I'm not so sure we contraction of the federal government is the most important thing here. I think the most important thing here is how we deal with the tax code itself and make it more simple. Let me give you a perfect example of the kind of thing that makes no sense at all. You can own a $1 million house, and you can have a $1 million house at the beach and a $1 million cabin in the woods, and you can have mortgages on all three of them and deduct them fully. In some instances, you can even put a mortgage on a boat and get a tax break on it. Now, I got to tell you, that kind of stuff is just obscene in a situation like we have.
But you ask the marine manufacturers, you ask the companies who employ hundreds of thousands of people, such as Regal, such as Sea Ray, those people depend on those tax benefits to keep those people employed.
If the answer is we have to have tax breaks for boats, which is certainly not something that everybody needs. Now, we're not talking about fishing boats. We're not talking about boats that are boats that...
We're talking pleasure craft. We're not talking work boats. We're talking pleasure craft.
We're talking pleasure craft. Yeah, right. And there's no... That is a very small marketplace, and it isn't one that we have to worry about.
I would argue.
Fair enough.
I would argue and say, look, you know, one man's tax break is another man's paycheck. You've got a situation now where
that is phony as you can get. I happen to have a brother-in-law who's wealthy. He has a 67-foot yacht. I have watched him sit there for a few minutes at the dock and put $5,000 worth of gasoline into that boat. Now, don't tell me that he can't afford, that he needs tax breaks in order to be able to get a boat that runs on $5,000 worth of gasoline.
What he's probably able to do is take a depreciation deduction on the yacht.
Yeah, but I still go back to explain to the workers in Merritt Island, Florida, my home county, it employs several hundred skilled, high-paid labor jobs. Explain to those workers, because now what we have is we have an economy that is not conducive to, secondary spending, we'll call it, on stuff like pleasure craft. But if that tax break is there, that might compulse me, if I have the funds to do it, to buy a boat and keep those people employed. Explain it to the 600 people at Sea Ray.
Listen, if the decision for you to buy a pleasure boat has to do with if you get a tax deduction or not on it, then you shouldn't even be considering buying a damn thing. I mean, think about it. I mean, that's not the way we do our business. That kind of thinking is what gets us in this damn trouble.
Now, furthermore, the boat owners and the boat builders and the boat sellers are not the only people we're going to have to do a lot of tall explaining to. Social Security recipients, people whose retirement isn't going to be what they thought it was. This is going to be tough all across the board, and we will be explaining a lot of bad things to a lot of good
people.
I couldn't agree more with that. We have so many things that are a hell of a lot more difficult that we're going to have to do. And I'm sorry for the boat builders, but the fact of the matter
is... That's just one sector, one example.
I don't mean to sound, harsh, but it's minuscule in the structure of things. But it sends the kind of messages that I think are just terrible. You have deductions for boats, or deductions for second and third and fourth and fifth houses, that all the financial guys who have screwed the economy to death in the last couple of years are playing around with.
I want to address that, because when we talk about, let's look at a second home. If you look at a second home, that mortgage deduction that I take, it may be, look, I need to get out of town. I know for a fact I have a second home in Florida. I deduct that mortgage out of my taxes. When I go to Florida, I have a ripple effect. I fly the airline down to Orlando. I pay gas in that county. I pay taxes in that county. I buy food. I go to restaurants. I help support the economy. So not only do I support the economy in my hometown of Washington, D.C., but I also do it down in Melbourne, Florida. If I can do that, that's reason to – I create jobs. I mean, I'm being a little bit broad in this, but the facts still remain.
Okay, Justin. good pork. What are you going to cut?
What am I going to cut?
Yeah.
Okay, I will tell you what I would cut. If I'm going to be in the hot seat, I will tell you. I think, you know, with the longevity of life increasing, people living longer here in America, it is not, and people working longer, it is not unfair to say, let's raise the retirement age. Why don't we bump it up? Why does it have to be 51? Why does it have to be 60? Why don't we make it 65? Why don't we push the border or push the envelope and put it towards 70? That you have to look at what is today's economic situation. We don't do that anymore. But nobody wants to go to the general public. Nobody wants to go to the farmer in Kansas and say, hey, when you're ready to retire, well, you got to put another 5 years in before you can actually claim
what
that.
What about allowing people to opt out of Social Security? There's a growing movement.
That too is an option. But, Al, you were nodding your head.
I was going to say that I absolutely agree with you that idea of extending the age has got to be on the table. I think it's a much more serious proposal than worrying about boat builders.
But I say that, though, knowing full and well that I could have AARP coming down on me like a ton of bread.
You will have.
You will.
You will have. And then somebody's got to say to the AARP, where are you going to cut?
Yeah.
I mean, everybody who objects to a proposal has got to come up, I think will politically have to come up with their alternative.
What people forget is many people that have second or third homes, they're able to get around paying their property taxes by getting these homes on the historic preservation list.
Well, I mean, I can't claim my circa 1990 condo in Florida as being historical by any means.
I can tell you where Obama stayed. The person got that place on the historic preservation list and only pays a minimal amount of property tax.
But, I mean, look, there's other things. I don't pay the full amount of my taxes here in Washington, D.C. I claim homestead exemption. I'm sure that all of us around the table claim homestead exemption. Do you want to take away homestead exemption?
I think we have to focus on helping small businesses.
You don't have homestead exemption.
What the hell is a homestead exemption?
Homestead exemption is a tax break for your primary residence that you can take off a certain percentage of your property taxes because of the fact that you spend a majority of your time in that residency, and you can write it off.
Like people in Florida do a lot of that.
Right.
I assume my accountant
Florida,
knows
Texas,
about this.
A couple of others.
Well, I was gonna say, Al and Bob now are going to be phone calling their accountants here the next 24 hours to find out what the hell's going on.
You can't pull that in Virginia. Put it that way. What we're missing is we have to promote the growth and development of small business in this country. That's the engine for creating jobs and economic prosperity. And we have to make sure that any taxes do not adversely affect people that are engaged in job creation.
But I go back to the idea of a lot of those small businesses. Let's take, for example, small businesses that are started up here inside the Beltway. A lot of them start up as providing services and products to the federal government. When we do that, those small businesses have to, in many instances, rely on the larger businesses to partner up with them to bring them along to these large contracts in order for them to do that. Now, if we're creating tax, if we're closing some of those tax loopholes and we're getting company, you know, some of the defense contractors, and they can't afford to lose some of that revenue to some of the smaller businesses, we're contracting small business opportunities.
Well,
so
that's
where
you bring in businesses from other countries to help partner with.
I don't think that's going to be the answer as well. I mean, we still have, look, you bring in another a company from another country, arguably, you could say, well, we're taking away American jobs because not all of those jobs are going to reside inside the boundaries of the continental United States.
You have economic free trade zones, that will be very helpful and stimulate jobs.
Okay. Canada, yes. Mexico, eh. China, you look at the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China. The BRIC countries, I don't know that they could come in here and set up an operation here in the United States and be able to sustain the argument that we are creating American jobs. A lot of them do. We've seen it with BMW. We've seen it with Toyota. We've seen it with Honda. Very prevalent in the car manufacturing community. But I don't think we can do the same thing with high tech. And I think that that's going to be an issue that we're going to have to address ultimately.
We're doing it with high tech in Silicon Valley and the corridor up in North Carolina and Virginia. So it can be done.
I will tell you, this has been a really heated discussion. I like this. This makes for good radio.
And we haven't even mentioned the defense budget.
No, look at that. Time for a break, Al. We're going to take a 2-minute break here.
Typical Democrat. Yeah,
that's right. We're going to take a break. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom on Blog Talk Radio. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
Of the sun and west of the moon, we'll build a dream house of love. We'll keep
Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Back Room on Blog Talk Radio. With us, as they are every Tuesday here in Shelley's Back Room, is our usual roundtable of pundits. He is the former 8-term member of Congress from Washington 2nd District, former vice president of Burlington Northern Railroad. He is Congressman Al Swift. Al, welcome back.
Cut your fence.
Oh, stop. Moving on, directly across from me, he is the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald Ford. He is the former vice president of the National Broadcasting Corporation, former board member of the National Association of Broadcasters, and longtime parliamentarian in the Republican Party. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, welcome back for our second hour.
Glad to be here.
And he is the vice president of the Eurasia Center. He is a bar-certified attorney here in Washington, D.C. and the great state of New York. He is our international affairs expert. He is Dr. Ralph Winney. Ralph, welcome back.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
And joining us today here in the smoke-encrusted nerve center of Backroom Politics here at Shelley's is my friend Joe Williams. He's the executive director of AMAS Services for the Aging here in Washington, D.C. He's a longtime community activist. He's a longtime resident. He's a lifetime resident of the District of Columbia and a general insider on all things going on here in D.C. Joe, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Wow, this is a treat. This is a treat for us. As always, for those of you out in Radio Land, you can join the discussion here on Backroom Politics. You can call in at 619-638-8477. Again, 619-638-8477. Joe, let's start off with you. Joe, tell us a little bit, first of all, on what you're doing here in D.C. when it comes to representing the interests of the aging population here in the district.
Sure thing. I run an agency, Emmaus Services for the Aging. We provide services for about 10,000 seniors here in the district, mostly your low-income and vulnerable elderly. Low-income is based on what, by HHS guidelines, individuals who are living at least 20% below the poverty level. You have seniors who are actually living in the District of Columbia off a Social Security income of $780 per month.
Is that a sustainable income for somebody here in the District of Columbia, even in some of the in some of the not so popular districts here in the district?
Well, those individuals who are living on those that number, that Social Security number,
right,
don't live in Ward 3. So let's get that straight. of Northwest D.C. But they live normally east of the river or in between what we call in between the tracks in Wards 2 and 4 and 1.
Right.
And so, and without supplements, without organizations that provide assistance, I know these people wouldn't survive.
What kind of services do you guys provide to the community here?
We are a holistic wraparound service. We from anything from food programs, to rental assistance, to utility assistance, to what we call social services in terms of a social worker providing case management, all the way around to helping them to navigate the systems of the District of Columbia. Those are the things that we do. We like to say that we provide services for the frisky, the fragile, and the frail.
which, by the way, is how we refer to Bob and Al all the time.
Am I frail or frisky?
we like to refer to you as fragile, Bob. Joe, you're doing amazing things for the aging community that in need here in the district, and this is a really tough town. You're talking about a town that now has the most expensive commercial real estate in the country. You're talking about a town that has some of the most expensive residential real estate in the country. How do you balance that, the needs of the aging population here in D.C., with the fact that you are in the hub of really expensive real estate?
Well, we remind our local politicians that seniors do vote, and they vote all the time, and they vote regularly. That is the consistent voting block here in the District of Columbia, and we rally them around by advocating for their needs. I mean, if in fact that there are, as it relates to housing, for example, in the mayor's budget, you see I got this document I've been reading all day like it's a Bible, but the mayor's budget has come out, and there are some real challenges in trying to close a $322.1 million gap. But you can't balance it on the backs of safety net programs and social services. So one of the things that we've done is we've challenged all the legislators and the mayor in a lot of backroom meetings, if you would, saying that where is the waste taking place in the district's budget that we can really reallocate to help those who are in need? So if, in fact, that you have individuals who have been taking advantage of entitlement programs for a number of years, I mean, for example, the TANF program was never meant to sustain people for a lifetime. It was only meant to help people to get up on their feet. If, in fact, you have people who have it has become a systemic issue, then address the systemic issue so that you can reallocate those dollars. So what we do is we help them to look at holes that, or places that they haven't seen.
Now, for those of you out nationwide who are listening to the show, this is obviously not just a district-wide issue. This is a national issue. We were talking earlier, Joe, about the budget and some of the cuts that are coming out. And I'm sure that there are similar organizations like yours nationwide that are experiencing the little pinch that's going on as a result of our economy. When we talk about your budget in particular, it's probably not unlike the other organizations nationwide. How much of your budget comes from federal spending or federal programs?
Well, our program, the money as an agency is providing services for seniors in the district is a little different. That the money's come from the Administration on Aging and come to the district government, and then they are allocated to organizations. Most state aging agencies provide the services themselves. The district doesn't. The district actually uses nonprofits to do the services. So the local funding is somewhere around $18 million, and then the federal funding is somewhere around $9 million. So, and it's a small, as you can see, not a whole lot of money to serve over 100,000 individuals
may have been. Joe, I was going to ask you, how would a federal government shutdown impact the work that you're doing?
Well, that means that we won't be able to, you know, to get paid for anything that we do through the district programming because they're not essential. The Office on Aging is a stopgap agency, for example. So it's not an essential kind of operation. So it will literally shut down everything except the like the feeding program, the home-based feeding programs, and some of the wraparound care of the health care aides.
But medical transport to doctor's appointments will stop as a result of the government shutdown?
If in fact they're provided properly, yes. Because if people, once the allocation runs out, they will, and we've had this before, we're just told that there's certain things you can't do.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned the mayor's budget. You guys are arguably working on a shoestring budget right now to provide these services to the aging population here in D.C. Has the mayor's office in the new budget that was just announced, are they getting the fact, the importance of your program? Are they seeing the fact that, you know, your program and other social programs like it are essential to keep residents inside the district sustainable?
I can't say if they're getting it. I'll tell you what I see. The mayor had put out for the Office on Aging, well, you keep using them as an example because there are other stopgap agencies that had the same challenge, where they had to cut 35% of their budget, all right? So, again, having those meetings, if you had cut the Office on Aging by 35%, you would have decimated it. There would have been no services for seniors in the District of Columbia. But having those meetings with the budget folks, showing them, giving them an analysis of showing what would happen if you cut 35% now, how on the back end you'll end up paying 180% because of all the costs and the havoc you would cause, they flatlined it at the same levels of last year. Now I say that to say that they are at least starting to understand the importance of it by not cutting it by 35%. Now, but that's on a historical note that the budget over the last 25 years has flatlined and it has not increased by 3% over the last 20 years.
So you're not even getting a cost of living adjustment.
You're not getting the cost of living. You're not getting the inflation coverage. So the budget really has really taken a hit. If you compare it to the analysis directly, it's taken a hit by over 22% because of the fact you're not getting the cost of living, you're not keeping with inflation, and you don't have the rates that are comparable to what the costs are now.
Now being inside the being a subsidized agency inside the District of Columbia, obviously D.C. government, we've had this discussion before, Joe, is basically is viewed by many on the Hill as a federal agency, mm-hmm. not as the center of, you know, the city where American government resides. Does that pose a problem? Does that view from the Hill pose a problem to you getting your message out and providing those services to the population?
Most definitely. Well, I'll just say this. It poses a problem because it doesn't allow the district to operate as an independent entity. Everything that we do, and I'm a native Washingtonian, you know, we've
right.
had this discussion before.
Right.
I'm fourth generation, and so I've been here all my days. And until that, and I say this on both parts, until we see ourselves as a state and start operating as a state, and then we are forced others to see us, we will continue to have these kinds of issues. People telling us how we can raise taxes or how we can't raise taxes or how we can institute this and can't institute that. But it's incumbent upon us to make sure that we take care of our own backyard and make sure that we do the things that are necessary so the citizens of the district become like the citizens of the rest of the United States.
Well, I want to pose a question to Bob and Al. I mean, the question of D.C. sovereignty and having at least a vote in Congress has now direct impact into the services that the district provides to its residents. Why is this such an issue, Bob, that you see that we can't get that vote? That there's something that just prevents the Hill from saying, look, you know, these people pay taxes, they contribute to the general fund, why not give them that voice?
Well, all that's true, and I don't know what the motivation is to some people, but There is potentially, it's never been adjudicated, but there is a question with respect to whether they qualify as a state because they are not a state. It's a District of Columbia. It was carved out deliberately as a government, the headquarters of the government. I think that obviously there are problems because of that. But until we find, we need to decide one way or another whether we whether we're going to treat them like a state, which I think would probably need some kind of legislation, or we're going to leave them the way they are, which is, you know, in effect, in somewhat of a case, a second-class place.
Al, as a former member of Congress, I mean, this is an issue that comes up almost every year in Congress. During your time, I know that it's probably come up two, three or four times. There was always some solid legislation to give D.C. that vote. Why are the members of Congress reluctant to speak out in this issue?
Republicans are reluctant because it's so Democratic. It just assures that that you'll have a voting member in the House that is for sure going to be Democratic. Now, the former congressman from Virginia, the Republican congressman from Virginia, who's now retired,
Tom Davis.
He working, I think, with Eleanor Holmes Norton.
Yes, very closely.
Figured out a way to balance that out.
And Eleanor Holmes Norton, for those who aren't familiar, is the delegate who sits in Congress but does not. She's basically the district's congresswoman but does not have a vote in Congress.
Yeah, that's right. Not on the floor.
Not on the floor. In committee, she does.
In committee, right. She's in here.
Right.
And
she's about as effective as you could be for someone who doesn't have a vote on the floor.
She is. I have enormous respect for her. And she's done more without a vote. But the fact remains that nobody in anybody else's district cares a lot about the District of Columbia. They're not aware of it. My district was the second district of Washington State, north of Seattle, and it had all its problems, and they wanted me taking care of those things. Anything that I might have done for the District of Columbia would be pro bono. In political terms, and so it doesn't get the attention that it should.
Go on.
Sorry, I'm a little run on here, but the thing I want to make: getting a vote for D.C. is so much more important than I think most members of Congress think it is. It is the difference between how you can negotiate with your colleagues for what you need for your district. Montana only has one congressman, but it can vote.
Right. I think fundamentally it comes down to what the founding fathers wanted, and it was to make D.C. The head of the government. It was never intended to be a state.
Well, I mean, we can argue. I mean, nobody also intended that it would have the population it did. Nobody anticipated that would be the case.
And I'm not arguing it should be a state. I'm not arguing that it should have two senators.
I agree.
But I think, that's another thing. But Eleanor Holmes Norton or whoever the representative is should be able to have the vote, which will make her more capable of providing representation for the people in the District of Columbia.
But as a resident of the District of Columbia, I will say this, that the systemic problem for many of us is the fact that we are required to do the same thing that everybody else has to do as a member of this country. You pay your taxes, you know, you pay federal taxes, you pay your local taxes, and then we don't have a shot or a say in what happens at the federal level. I mean, to say that, okay, Eleanor does a great job, and I support her all heartedly. But you know how she's measured in the district? She is measured about the impact of how close she's gotten us to statehood. All right? Everything else that she does really is secondary.
Is that a fair metric for Eleanor?
Whether it's fair or not, it's the reality. And that's the point I want to drive. While at one point we may have determined that this was the way that we were going to do something, times change. We're an adaptable country. We're always moving. We call ourselves progressive. We call ourselves, you know, being assertive. Well, there are residents here. There's 600,000 who are here,
right?
Who live here, who are people, who are part of this territory or this district, who do everything else that everybody else in this country do. So to say that, you know, we gotta maintain what the founding fathers, what their thought was, well, you know, because you found something doesn't mean it stays the same way. Heck, I got somebody's name on my building now, but if you gave me $1 million, I'll put your name on it.
Hey,
the Al Swift Center for Aging. let's talk a little bit about the budget impact here, Joe. We briefly touched on the mayor's budget. The mayor's budget, you're basically working off of 1990s type money versus 2011 money, which is gonna have an impact in the way you operate. But has there been? Do you have advocates inside City Council? Do you have advocates in Chairman Kwame Brown and Mayor Vince Gray now?
Well, I will say this. There's an old statement that you all are politicians. I'm not that, you know, that in politics, everybody isn't your friend forever, and everybody's your enemy forever. And while I've had these quirky relationships for a number of years with the mayor, in fact, I've worked for him directly over 10 years and known him much longer, and Chairman Brown. The key is everybody getting what it is that they're looking for. Now, the best way that I advocate for behalf of our seniors, for example, we had a hearing regarding the oversight of the Office on Aging and what is its objectives and the like. So what we do is that we don't just take ourselves. We fill the chambers with the individuals who we're serving. So we fill the main chamber with over 800 people, had them open the overflow with another 500 people. That had a dramatic impact, all right, because it was all shown on district cable TV. People around the city saw it. It made a tremendous impact. The best way that we keep those advocates, we keep reminding them of who they're working for. You know, the mayor, for example, in his budget, he has his objectives. He has public safety, he has education, he has jobs. Well, nowhere, he'll say to you that the seniors are wrapped in the public safety piece, all right? So that's where they are, but theoretically, but really, in reality, they aren't. And so we have to keep them before him. The safety net programs have been cut by 58% of the district budgets. Now, what this also says is, but this budget, are you ready to hear this? Is contingent upon the fact that Congress is going to give the federal allotment. And it says it's supposed to give.
So you're caught in a catch-22.
That's right. So if this budget means nothing, if in fact the Congress says that we're going to cut your allotment by 20%.
Thus taking away our independence in spending on services.
So here we are. I'm paying federal taxes, and you're telling me you're not going to give me any money to help my territory.
Yeah, that. Well, we're going to take a quick break here. We're here with Joe Williams, who's the executive director of Amanis Center for Aging. He is a community activist, longtime D.C. political insider. He's going to stay with us for the hour. We're very fortunate to have him and our usual roundtable of Al Swift, Bob Hines, Ralph Winnie, and myself. Stay with us. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital on Blog Talk Radio. We'll be right back. Thank you. We're back here live at Chili's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio. With us again is our special guest, Joe Williams. Joe, we were talking before about the budget impact on the city budget, but what we haven't talked about is the federal impact on the budget crisis. Are you noticing a lot of concern, a lot of tension in what's going on the Hill regarding the possible budget cuts as they're coming up through?
Well, you know, we're all antsy in regard to trying to figure out what's going to come of it. What are the decisions that are going to be made? You know, when will they make a decision to stop fighting? You know, one of the things that I've said before, and you all help me, all of those individuals who are political appointees get paid in the midst of a government shutdown, all right?
No, they will not.
Yeah, well, how about Congress? Congress get paid for government shutdown?
Sure.
Yes. Yeah, they do.
Because they're essential.
Wait.
That's a good question.
Wait, Al? Al?
If you ask a congressman whether he's essential, of course. If you ask his constituents, you may get a different answer.
Joe brings up a good point, because you know, one of the things that I've heard, there's been some rumbling, and my understanding is there's actually a bill ready to go in the hopper that says if the government does shut down, they're going to stop paying Congress. And there's a couple of members that are pushing that, and it won't be retroactive.
I'd vote for it. I think if Congress can't do its job, which is keep the government running, then why should it be paid during the time it's not running?
Well, there's breaking news out of Politico right now. Politico is announcing that President Obama, after today's meeting, said the following, that the congressional leaders, including Speaker Boehner, including Senator Harry Reid, need to start acting like grown-ups and reach a budget agreement. And he further says that we're closer than ever we've been to an agreement, and said that the differences are quote, not a basis for a shutdown. The president's taking a really strong stance on this budget issue, and he's got his sights set on Capitol Hill.
It goes back to the fact that Boehner and Reid do not like each other.
I think it's a little bit beyond that. I think that's a stretch, but there's no
question.
They don't have
the same respect.
I would say that regardless of the relationship, the president's setting the gauntlet down. Al, is that a good move?
I think it's an excellent move on his part. He has demonstrated conclusively, it seems to me from that statement, that he does not want a shutdown, and that there is no reason to have a shutdown. This is a very good position from which to argue. And if they shut it down, to blame. So politically, it's excellent. I also happen to think it's true. It's always nice when something's politically good is also true. It doesn't happen often. And I think that it may even have some effect on the Hill. The fact that Congress needs some adult supervision, and the president seems to be volunteering as an adult.
He's acting presidential, is what it comes down to.
Bob?
I think the last few days, the president has positioned himself in such a way as to say, I've done everything I can.
Yeah.
And it's up to them, and why don't they get their act together?
Balls in their court, basically.
Yeah.
Well,
but it's also fair to say that it isn't just the fact that Reid and Boehner cannot get together. They both have problems within their own bodies, number one. And number two, the president, let's put it this way, if Harry Reid stepped aside and said, okay, I'll do whatever Boehner wants, the president wouldn't agree, because he doesn't want some of those riders in there that are in there.
Well,
so he wouldn't agree. The point is, he looks you know, really clean and really trying to be helpful, but he's got some of the same problems that Reed has with respect to the substance.
Well, let's talk about some of these riders. I mean, the riders have been pretty much the center point of the disparity between the two sides. Two of the biggest issues that are on the plate right now are Medicaid and Medicare, and Social, we'll throw Social Security for the hat trick. That's going to directly impact you, any sort of cuts. They're talking about $40 billion in cuts, which would include Medicare and Medicaid.
Yeah, but when you think about it, let's think about the fact that the population that I talk about is on the Social Security income, you know, a little less than $800 a month. You won't cut their Medicaid benefits because of the fact that, what are you going to do, create an underclass? I mean, you know, who are they talking about cutting Medicaid benefits for, the poor? Or the perpetrating poor. Who are they talking about cutting those benefits for? When you start talking about cutting a safety net like that, what are you saying as a leader of the country?
Well, the Republican bill, if you're over 55, it doesn't change your Medicare or Medicaid. It
changes nothing.
Right. It's the younger generation.
But it's those on disabilities, right? I mean, because pretty much if you're on Medicaid, if you're talking about going forward.
Right.
Right. Well, I think, I mean, most of us are going to live and work until we're 80.
Right.
Bob might argue that point, but okay.
I'm 30, but yes.
If you ask Gail, yes.
but I think that is, again, you talk about when things, what the forefathers did when they created something.
Yeah.
When Social Security was created, it was created upon a contingency, if you want to throw your hat trick in there, that people were going to retire. 65 was a retirement age. Now, with the silver tsunami coming, and I don't know if you all know that term, silver tsunami.
That's a new one for us.
In 2020.
Yeah, the baby boom.
The baby boom was 25, almost 25% of the population will be 60 and over.
Sure.
And we are living longer. We are working longer. We're not retiring at 65.
And there are not enough people coming up through the system to pay for it.
That's right. Thus, it makes sense to make an adjustment on it. All right? That's in my mind. It makes sense to make an adjustment.
I think it's also worth pointing out that that when Social Security was created, life expectancy was a lot shorter than it is today.
Right. And that's what I said. That it actually, so now, you know, again, if it's not working as it originally thought to be, then it should be changed. I go back to state or to the district. It should be changed because of what we started at. And where we are, we're two different places now.
What do you think of privatizing Social Security?
Oh, bad idea. I'm sorry.
Why is that?
Well, I mean, who are we gonna put it? Whose hands are we gonna put it in? I mean, what? Which bank that just screwed up?
Oh, AIG, bro.
Yeah.
Al.
Well, what about BlockRound? How about Fannie Mae running?
There are certain things I think that need to remain. As much as it hurts me to say this. Certain things need to remain in the hands of the government.
Social Security is one of them.
Social Security is
one of them. What about, so you don't support block grants?
Not in total, depending on if in fact I'm on the block of getting the grant. No, I'm on the
Wow. For those who'd like to call in, speak with us, we've got Joe Williams here in the smoke-encrusted nerve center of Backroom Politics. Please feel free to call in. Our number is 619-638-8477. Again, that number is 619-638-8477. If you have any questions about anything going on in the district politics, what's going on the Hill, international affairs, it's open game. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in 2 minutes. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom. We'll be back in a second. Stay with us.
You know.
Of the sun and west of the moon, we'll build a dream house of love.
Shelly's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. This is Blog Talk Radio's Backroom Politics Live from Shelly's Back Room. We were talking a little bit before about the budget and the effect it's going to have, especially on local communities such as here in the D.C. area. Joe Williams from Amanis Aging has been gracious enough to join us for the 5 o'clock hour. But we want to report on breaking news. Breaking news out of Politico saying that sources are reporting that Debbie Wasserman Schultz, congresswoman out of southeast Florida, out of Palm Beach County, out of Broward County, is going to be named the next chair of the DNC, next chair of the Democrat National Committee. That's a big one, because I know that word was that former Governor Ted Strickland was in the running for that. That's going to be a shift.
And Ted Strickland was a moderate on the liberal side, but a moderate and experience in Congress and as governor.
One term in
Ohio.
He
did a good job.
Yeah. Oh, he did a fantastic job. And, but here's the funny thing about it is, I mean, with Governor Strickland, you get somebody who is very, you know, moderate, willing to cut deals. Congresswoman Wasserman Schultz, I got to tell you something. She's far to the left. She's very close to the Pelosi camp, very tight with the Obama administration, and serves as the real liberal voice of the Hill when it comes to especially social issues. Bob, does this represent, or actually, Al, let me go to you. Does this represent a dichotomic change in the way that the DNC...
What kind of a change?
A dynamic change. Dynamic change. Let me get that word out.
A kinetic
change. Good. Yeah, I could do that too. Does this represent a dynamic change in the direction?
Absolutely. And you can see Nancy Pelosi's fingerprints all over it. It seems to me that when the Democratic Party decides that they're going to bypass a demonstrably competent moderate from the middle of America, and instead we're going to go to
arguably the far left.
The far left, from a state where the Democrats tend to be on the far left, that this is a mistake. This is a mistake.
Bob?
Well, I would tend to agree with Al for this reason. The fundamental responsibility of any party chairperson is to raise money, particularly when we're going into a presidential campaign, to help raise money all over the place. You know, not just for the presidential candidate.
Do any of us know what the record is of either of these two possibilities in fundraising?
Because Wasserman Schultz was tied directly to Pelosi, she's done very, very well.
I can tell you right now from experience, she is a money-making machine. When she was, she actually came up through the ranks. She started off as a state representative in Tallahassee, became a state senator, and in each one of her races just blew out the money trail of her opponents.
And what do we know about the other one?
Governor Strickland, he's a more conservative fundraiser. My understanding is, and Bob, you probably know better than I, he's been traditionally a solid fundraiser. He's definitely been a solid voice in getting the funds together. But I got to tell you, it's a strange. Well, it's almost an apples and oranges, in my opinion.
Wasserman Schultz is very connected with the New York Jewish community and has been able to raise a ton of money for their party. So that's one of the reasons why they picked her.
Joe.
But I wonder if there's a shift, or is this a relationship shift with this, because the Obama campaign has now said it's going after big money, when before, in his first campaign, he did more of the grassroots dollar raising.
Right.
He's now saying that he's going after big money. So maybe this is why she's being put in.
Al?
And that might make... That might make... It's very hard for me to say this. That might make me change my mind when I said it's a mistake. If, in fact, it is true that the primary function of the DNC chairman is to raise money, and she can raise more than Ted can, then maybe it's not a mistake.
But she can certainly raise one hell of a lot of money on the left coast and the east coast.
Yeah, the Northeast Corridor, she can definitely raise money.
She can raise a lot of money out in Hollywood. She can raise a ton of money out in California.
Absolutely.
She can probably do that. Now, on the other hand, she will probably also find, but it may not make much difference, she will probably also find it a lot tougher to work with
the blue dog money.
The blue dog money, some of the more conservative Democratic governors in their states try to help them, because she is an in-your-facer.
Well, she is very arguably a polarizing figure inside D.C. politics. Yes. She has been very, very liberal on social programs, which might be a benefit to you, Joe, in your program. You know, if you have somebody in the DNC that's pushing for a arguably liberal social platform, getting social services out in front, Planned Parenthood, Medicare, Medicaid, that whole package, that's got to be something that's going to get your attention.
Well, not only that, though, but I think the Democratic Party feels that they need to be on a real offensive during this upcoming election. And they're going to have the dollars. So this is just not for the president's campaign alone. This is for pitting, you know, individuals against in Congress and the like. So I think this is a move that's necessary if, in fact, they're going to hit the ground running.
But they run the risk of alienating conservative Democrats and blue dogs, especially.
Yeah.
Those are the kind of people that put Obama into power, not just the liberal wing.
Well, it's definitely going to be interesting to see how this plays out. We've heard rumors about Governor Strickland. We're now hearing rumors through sources at Politico that Debbie Wasserman Schultz is going to be the next chairman. Next 48 hours is going to be very interesting, particularly with, Tim Kaine, former Governor Tim Kaine, now running for U.S. Senate in Senator Jack Webb's seat, is going to be a very interesting play as far as he is, I would say, in my opinion, somewhat of a moderate when it comes to his positions here in D.C. So that's going to be an interesting change to see how this all plays out. Let's turn the table a little bit and talk about some internal D.C. issues. Joe, you've been very close to several of the administrations, the Fenty administration prior, the current administration down at City Hall with Vince Gray. Vince Gray's had a tough, tough first 100 days. I mean, we haven't seen stuff like this coming out since Marion Barry.
Leave my friend alone.
What has been the problem? Why has it been so difficult for Vince Gray to really get his hands around what's going on inside his administration, and how has he not been able to stop the hemorrhaging of popularity? He's down now into the 30s, I heard.
Well, you know, one of the challenges that Mayor Gray has is that he's tried to keep his fingers on things as opposed to wrapping his hands on things. And you got to have people around you, as you all know, that have your best interest and the best interest of the citizens at heart. Well, we're learning now, like out of yesterday's news, last night it came out that one of his closest advisors, she's no longer going to be nominated for the position of handling the Washington Convention Center and all that. She's backed away from that, which was a very good move because Lorraine Green needed to go.
Right.
Right? Because she became a polarized figure. He had to let go of his chief of staff because she became a polarized figure. And there are a few others that he's going to have to let go so that he can start now chalking up some victories. There are some things that he's done, but that they've been so overshadowed, you know, by the other stuff. He's in a no-win situation right now. He stands a very good chance of being a one-term mayor. And I think it will impact one of what I consider one of Washington's greatest citizens. Vince Gray, as the director of human service agencies, as the director of human services in the district, has the heart of helping people. But he made the mistake, I think, this is my opinion,
right,
of trying real hard not to get involved in nepotism and putting some people who've ridden with him along the way in positions that he put some other people in. And now it came back to bite them.
Well, you know, we've heard several pieces, we've seen several pieces in the Post. We've heard people around town talking that Vince Gray has been making some very amateur mistakes in his term as mayor. But he's by no means an amateur in the political scene here in D.C. or even nationwide. How does a veteran of D.C. politics get caught up in those amateur issues?
You know what? You listen to the wrong people. You surround yourself with people who are not giving you good advice. And one of the things that has hurt him, he has been a methodical thinker all his days. That methodical approach has hurt him. And he's trusted people who just did not carry his vision. And he didn't know it. I mean, I think this too. There's some more people who are, as using my term, they're going to fly out the building of the roof or the windows of the Wilson Building.
Right.
Because they need to. You know, this whole
the thing, Wilson Building, the City Hall.
Right. This whole thing with this whole campaign issue that came about, you know, when Mary Che conducts these hearings up, there's going to be some other people who are going to fall on the sword because they made some grave mistakes. You know, they played the game wrong.
But Al, does the mistakes that Vince Gray has done in the first 100 days and some of the mistakes of the previous administrations, such as, you know, withholding the baseball tickets and the dissension with city council of Mayor Fenty, the issues with your friend Marion Barry, arguably was very polarizing in politics here in D.C., do those problems resonate up on the Hill and help prevent them from giving full authority?
You're given a body that is not really very pro-DC to begin with, and they will leap upon anything that appears to be negative.
That's the problem.
Give
them ammunition.
Joe has just suggested that there is some merit to some of the criticisms. But one of the things that fascinates me about the media is that no matter how badly they have treated predecessors, when the new guy comes in, they start trying to bring him down. Now, I'm a former media guy.
Right.
You know, and I never understood it when I was in the media. I don't understand it now. And it just seems to me that an immediate search went out for what can we find wrong with the new mayor, rather than looking at what he was trying to do that was positive and covering that, it's let's go find out if he hasn't got a buddy somewhere that's uh, dust on it.
Yeah, Washington Post has a history of going after the mayor that they can't control. Now, you can say what you want. The problem that the Post had with Barry was that they could not control him. All right? They can't also now control Gray. And so they have been on him from day one. Think about it like this. A few weeks ago, there was an article in the Post regarding the contracts that Fenty did that were wrong, and that they
sole source contracts that Fenty
they
would roll out for, right?
They were wrong, and while they didn't say that he did anything illegal, they were wrong. All right, now that hit the Post, and it hit like the bottom part of the metro section,
right?
The local section, right?
Right.
All right, and it kind of just slid under the radar. But that was a major piece 6 months ago.
Right.
All right? So the point is that when you're right, Congressman Al, that the polarization of trying to highlight the wrong in a mayor is in fact due to the fact that they cannot control Gray. And Gray, that's the one thing about him, he won't be controlled by the media.
Ralph.
Well, I think one of the issues he got a lot of flack about was when Michelle Rhee had to resign.
She didn't have to resign. Let's get that correct.
Okay.
Michelle Rhee was offered the opportunity to stay. Michelle Rhee assassinated herself when she said it was a sad day for district children that Fenty lost.
The fact of the matter is everyone was bashing Michelle Rhee because she was not towing the line with what the unions wanted.
Well, I don't think that's the full case. Michelle Rhee alienated herself. She, you know what? You can try to do good things. And here's Michelle Rhee's problem. Michelle Rhee didn't have all of parental support as it was so given. I mean, again, Michelle Rhee alienated people. She pushed people away. There were people who wanted to work with her, and she didn't want to be worked with.
And she reemphasized the arrogance of
the Fenty administration. Right. And you, in this town, if you're not working with people, you won't survive in a position.
Right.
Period.
Well, let's take a look. You know, we've been talking about some of the hits that Mayor Gray's taken during his first 100 days, but you talk about the good things that he's done. What are some of the good things that stand out in your mind that he's not getting the attention for?
I'll tell you one thing for an example. He has protected some of the safety net things that had to be cut. And the very fact that he listened, as I said earlier, about rerouting poorly used district dollars. That has not been the habit of any government. You know, one of the things that did work in this whole budget cycle,
right,
that we had the mayor to and had his people to look at those programs that were being operated by entities that were wasting the dollars. So they weren't getting any impact, they weren't getting they weren't meeting any objectives, and they were just spending and wasting dollars. So the mayor was able, through our efforts, take dollars away from those non-working programs, cut some of that dollars and give it to programs and other programs that were working.
Right.
That's a smart thing to do in terms of the safety net fee. But, you know, the whole sustaining the educational system, the education effort on education reform has not stopped. But the very fact that all this other stuff is happening is overshadowed. Public safety, the very fact that he kept Kathleen Lanier.
Right.
Right. When everybody else said, get rid of her. This lady had the highest approval rating
of anybody
in the government, okay? So it was a smart move to keep her. He's done some things to help to keep sustaining, and he has those things helped him to possibly gain momentum, but his momentum has been halted by the minutiae.
Right.
Should he have been critical of Obama for getting rid of the D.C. Opportunity Scholarship Program, which had a lot of support among the D.C. low-income?
Well, it did. Let me say this. I ran programs with education support programs that I Have a Dream Foundation back in the 80s and the 90s, okay? And the reality is that those dollars for poor people only help you to a point because we then had to find other subsidies to help those kids go to those schools. So while that program does have an opportunity to get you at the door, it doesn't necessarily get you in the door.
Are the charter schools effective in the district?
I'm a D.C. public school graduate. So, and I'm sitting here at the table with you all. So
right.
That says a lot about D.C. public schools.
Right.
Unless your school system was racked.
Right.
Stuff like that. But the point is that DCPS has the opportunity to work for all of its residents if, in fact, you put all the necessary resources behind it and you govern it rightly.
Right. All right. Well,
that last point is awfully important.
Governor Reitman.
Yes.
Governor
yes.
Reitman.
The money has always been.
Listen, Vincent Reed was my superintendent.
Right.
Vincent Reed ran with an ironclad fist, all right? And he governed the school system, and they did not waste a dollar. And he had lieutenants who were principals who understood what he was doing, and that made it work back in the 60s and the 70s.
All right. Well, we're going to take a break, and we're going to come into our last segment here on Backroom Politics. We're going to take 2 minutes. Stay with us. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital. Stay with us.
About a 4-year-old child in Southeast who is the child of a 20-year-old drug addict prostitute. The question is, what chance in the world does that kid have, and is there anything that can be done about it?
Well, let me say this. I've run and worked with social service organizations for a number of years. If this young lady is 20 years old and she's prostituting, she's a prime candidate to get help from organizations like Covenant House Washington. And I raise them up because of the fact that Covenant House is a social service, independent social service nonprofit that will provide services that will help her to come out of that position and to get her to a stabilized point of where she can then be a help to her child. And there are stories like that, Congressman Al, that have been rampant in the city. When I ran programs back in the 80s and the 90s under youth development, there were young people who were not only prostituting, but they were on the brink of prostituting their 12-year-old children. And these were 30-year-old mothers, okay? And so you get them hooked and get them connected to other organizations. You know, there's an organization that's called HIPS, Helping Prostitutes to Survive. So helping
right.
something prostitutes survive. You get them connected with organizations like that to help them get out of it. Because the other piece of it is when you have people who are in prostitution, you can on the local level, on the domestic side, involve human trafficking out of the Department of Justice. So we've created relationships like that that will be able to help them so that that child can then get help. Because what will happen if we don't is the child has to be taken. And that becomes more of a snowballing effect.
Yes.
You know, and as somebody who grew up in Southeast D.C.,
right.
who lived that was living to me next door on a regular basis, you know, those are the kind of interventions that have to be made and that can be made.
But I have a question because it strikes me, using Al's example, that if you're 20 years old and you have a kid and you're in prostitution, you probably don't have much education.
That's right.
And so even if you provide support systems, are they going to be able to take advantage of it?
Well, you provide the big three. The big three, as it relates on that side, would be education, would be housing, and would be a job.
Yeah.
All right? Those are the big three that individual would need. And so the first thing is to help them to go get a GED. Programs like Covenant House, Sasha Bruce, Latin American Youth Center, they have programs specifically targeted to what they deem as at-risk youth or high-risk youth. In this case, that's a high-risk youth, okay? And she still is at that age where she can get help. The key is somebody like you who will point her to somebody like me who can take her to somebody. You know what I mean? Because if you see that, you know, I ran an outreach program for almost 10 years, street outreach program, that we had. I trained people to be on the streets 10 a.m. in the morning to 1 a.m. in the morning. So the prostitutes are the ones that we targeted between 11 and 1 a.m., all right? And we had a good success rate of getting them turned around. And, yes, you have to have people who are street savvy enough to deal with the pimps.
Yeah, but I added another factor, which is terribly complicating, and that is drug addict.
Mm-hmm. But that's all a part of it.
That's all a part of it.
I mean, you know what? You know, let me say this to you. Most young people now who are, if they're hooked on, you know, the most crack, for example, that will get you hooked more than anything else. But the drug of choice for most young people between the ages of 12 and 20 is marijuana.
Oh, okay.
Right. That is the most drug of use, the drug of choice.
How do you feel about marijuana as the
medicinal
first step? Well, no.
Oh.
But it's the first step, and then you go
a doorway.
Yeah.
As a door, we call it the doorway drug.
Yeah,
it is
yeah.
a doorway drug. But the key is intervention. I will tell you that intervention can work for someone who wants something different. And many times they don't know that they want something different until they've shown something different. I've had kids. You ever heard the term born dead?
Yeah.
Born
yeah.
dead is a term that many young people use to say that I'm only born to die before I'm 21.
Right.
Meaning going into the gang.
No, not even that. Born dead. I'm born to die. So what that means is destructive behavior is the only path that I know to choose because I have no chance. I guarantee you, if she's 20 and she's in prostitution, along the way, her mother left her out to fend for herself. And so, again, and go back.
She didn't have a father.
That's right. Or if she had a father, he was locked up or he was not in life somewhere because of whatever kind of circumstance.
Would the mother tempt her out?
Maybe not.
Yeah.
I mean, there's all kinds of scenarios around it. I mean, you know, but I would tell you this, that what we need to do is that you can get intervention.
Well, I'll tell you right now, Joe, we're coming in the last 8 minutes of the show. As a resident of D.C., and anybody who's out there listening that lives in the district, how can we, as just a citizen of D.C., help your efforts and your cause?
Well, outside of donating to a wonderful organization.
Well, how do I donate?
Well, you can go to our website, www.emmausdc.org.
There are spell Emmaus.
E-M-M-A-U-S. It's like the Emmaus Road. If you have any, E-M-M-A-U-S.
Okay.
DC.org. There are wonderful opportunities up there to not only just donate, but you can volunteer. We have over 700 volunteers that work with our agency annually. They do everything from taking a senior to a doctor's appointment to
meals on wheels,
meals, lighthouse cleaning, the whole nine yards. So you can do it. There's a bunch of things that you can do in that regard. But I will say this also in terms of helping us. You know what? If you see a senior, let's not treat them as a throwaway citizen. We have a bad habit in this country that once you reach 60 or senior status, that you're now supposed to move aside and move on and let the younger generation do their thing. Well, I believe that, in fact, that because I believe in what I call the bridge builder effect. I'm only where I am because somebody else led the path for me to get here. They had to build a bridge to cross in order for me to cross that bridge to get to another bridge that I can build myself. I believe, as Dr. Edgar Kahn says, that there are no more throwaway people. And we have to honor our seniors. We have to give them that which is due to them. When I get to that season in my life, and I ain't far away, but when I get to that season in my life, you know, I don't want to be discarded as somebody who is a has-been. The relevance of what we provide and what we do and what we give is lifelong.
Joe, last question.
Bob and I, who are both 75, applaud.
I commend you, gentlemen. I commend you, gentlemen.
Joe, last question. The future of D.C., what is it going to take to get D.C. to be the premier city, to be that castle? What is it going to take? Is it going to take a vote in Congress? Is it going to take more investment in our youth here in D.C.? What is the one linchpin that makes D.C. the great city it could be?
I will say from a local perspective that we have to stop seeing ourselves as grasshoppers in the sight of others. And what I mean by that is that, listen, if you're fortunate to be an elected official, operate as if you are at a higher level than what others see you at, all right? You know, I've had discussions with people before, and I've said this. The mayor should see himself as a governor. The city council members should see themselves
as a legislator,
at the level of the Senate. And they need to start acting accordingly in that regard. Many people who will get into an elected position find themselves just being stuck at, quote-unquote, a local wall. I believe the impact of what we do is read everywhere. It's heard everywhere. We are under a microscope. If you change the view from those who are looking in that microscope, then you also begin to get some people who will advocate on your behalf to make some things happen. And that's what I believe that needs to happen in the city.
Joe, you want to announce anything today?
No, I do not.
Joe, folks, I want to thank Joe Williams from Emmaus. Here in D.C. and joining us for this last hour. It's been a great hour. Joe, thanks a lot. You're doing great things here in the district.
Thank you, man.
You have a great mission. Wish you continued success. If you'd like to donate, you can donate. We'll post the website on our firstcongress.org website. Please donate, volunteer, whatever you can give. Every little bit counts. We're going to quickly go through. We were going to go through tell me a story, but I got to tell you, the story that we were all going to tell as the chair of the DNC was blown out of the water in the past hour. Debbie Wasserman Schultz is going to be the next chairman of the DNC. So we're done there. On behalf of Congressman Al Swift, the Honorable Bob Hines, Dr. Ralph Winnie, I am your moderator, Justin Russell. This has been Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom in Washington, D.C. We'll be on next Tuesday, 4 to 6. On Blog Talk Radio. Have a great week, folks. Stay tuned.
Oh.